This is disc number 10.
The plasticity researchers Helen Neville and Donald Lawson, measuring neuronal firing rates to determine which sectors of the brain are active, found that deaf people intensify their peripheral vision to make up for the fact that they can't hear things coming at them from a distance. People who can hear use their parietal cortex, near the top of the brain, to process peripheral vision, whereas the deaf use their visual cortex at the back of the brain. Change in one brain module, here a decrease in output, leads to structural and functional change in another brain module, so that the eyes of the deaf come to behave much more like ears, more able to sense the periphery. Plasticity and sublimation, how we civilize our animal instincts. This principle that modules working together modify each other may even help explain how it is possible for us to mix together brute predatory and dominance instincts, processed by instinctual modules, with our more cognitive cerebral tendencies, processed by intelligence modules, as we do in sports or competitive games such as chess or in artistic competitions, to come up with activities that express both the instinctual and the intellectual in one activity. An activity of this kind is called a sublimation, a hitherto mysterious process by which brutish animal instincts are civilized. How sublimation occurs has always been a riddle. Clearly, much of parenting involves civilizing children, by teaching them to restrain or channel these instincts into acceptable expressions, such as in contact sports, board and computer games, theater, literature, and art. In aggressive sports such as football, hockey, boxing, and soccer, fans often express these brute wishes, kill him, flatten him, eat him alive, and so on. But the civilizing rules modify the expression of the instinct, so the fans leave satisfied if their team wins enough points. For over a century, thinkers influenced by Darwin conceded that we had within us brutish animal instincts, but they were unable to explain how sublimation of these instincts might occur. 19th-century neurologists, such as John Hewlings Jackson and the young Freud, following Darwin, divided the brain into lower parts that we share with animals and that process our brute animal instincts, and higher parts that are uniquely human and that can inhibit the expression of our brutishness. Indeed, Freud believed that civilization rests on the partial inhibition of sexual and aggressive instincts. He also believed we could go too far in repressing our instincts, leading us to develop neuroses. The ideal solution was to express these instincts in ways that were acceptable and even rewarded by our fellow humans, which was possible because the instincts, being plastic, could change their aim. He called this process sublimation. Yet, as he conceded, he never really explained exactly how an instinct might be transformed into something more cerebral. The plastic brain solves the riddle of sublimation. Areas that evolve to perform hunter-gatherer tasks, such as stalking prey, can, because they are plastic, be sublimated into competitive games, since our brains evolve to link different neuronal groups and modules in novel ways. There is no reason why neurons from the instinctual parts of our brains cannot be linked to our more cognitive cerebral ones and to our pleasure centers, so that they literally get wired together to form new wholes. These wholes are more than, and different from, the sum of their parts. Recall that Mrzenek and Pascual Léon argued that a fundamental rule of brain plasticity is that when two areas begin to interact, they influence each other and form a new whole. When an instinct, such as stalking prey, is linked up to a civilized activity, such as cornering the opponent's king on the chessboard, and the neuronal networks for the instinct and the intellectual activity are also linked, the two activities appear to temper each other. Playing chess is no longer about bloodthirsty stalking, though it still has some of the exciting emotions of the hunt. The dichotomy between low instinctual and high cerebral begins to disappear. Whenever the low and the high transform each other to create a new whole, we can call it a sublimation. Civilization is a series of techniques in which the hunter-gatherer brain teaches itself to rewire itself, and the sad proof that civilization is a composite of the higher and lower brain functions is seen when civilization breaks down in civil wars and brutal instincts emerge full force, and theft, rape, destruction, and murder become commonplace. Because the plastic brain can always allow brain functions that it has brought together to separate, a regression to barbarism is always possible, and civilization will always be a tenuous affair that must be taught in each generation and is always at most one generation deep. When the brain is caught between two cultures, the culturally modified brain is subject to the plastic paradox, discussed in Chapter 9, Turning Our Ghosts into Ancestors, which can make us either more flexible or more rigid, a major problem when changing cultures in a multicultural world. Immigration is hard on the plastic brain. The process of learning a culture, acculturation, is an additive experience, of learning new things and making new neuronal connections as we acquire culture. Additive plasticity occurs when brain change involves growth, but plasticity is also subtractive and can involve taking things away, as occurs when the adolescent brain prunes away neurons and when neuronal connections not being used are lost. Each time the plastic brain acquires culture and uses it repeatedly, there is an opportunity cost. The brain loses some neural structure in the process because plasticity is competitive. Patricia Kuhl of the University of Washington in Seattle has done brainwave studies that show that human infants are capable of hearing any sound distinction in all the thousands of languages of our species. But once the critical period of auditory cortex development closes, an infant reared in a single culture loses the capacity to hear many of those sounds, and unused neurons are pruned away until the brain map is dominated by the language of its culture. Now its brain filters out thousands of sounds. A Japanese 6-month-old can hear the English RL distinction as well as an American infant. At 1 year, she no longer can. Should that child later immigrate, she will have difficulty hearing and speaking new sounds properly. Immigration is usually an unending, brutal workout for the adult brain, requiring a massive rewiring of vast amounts of our cortical real estate. It is a far more difficult matter than simply learning new things, because the new culture is in plastic competition with neural networks that had their critical period of development in the native land. Successful assimilation, with few exceptions, requires at least a generation. Only immigrant children who pass through their critical periods in the new culture can hope to find immigration less disorienting and traumatizing. For most, culture shock is brain shock. Cultural differences are so persistent because when our native culture is learned and wired into our brains, it becomes second nature, seemingly as natural as many of the instincts we were born with. The tastes our culture creates in foods, in type of family, in love, in music, often seem natural, even though they may be acquired tastes. The ways we conduct nonverbal communication, how close we stand to other people, the rhythms and volume of our speech, how long we wait before interrupting a conversation all seem natural to us because they are so deeply wired into our brains. When we change cultures, we are shocked to learn that these customs are not natural at all. Indeed, even when we make a modest change, such as moving to a new house, we discover that something as basic as our sense of space, which seems so natural to us, and numerous routines we were not even aware we had, must slowly be altered while the brain rewires itself. Sensing and perceiving are plastic. Perceptual learning is the kind of learning that occurs whenever the brain learns how to perceive with more acuteness, or, as occurs in the sea gypsies, in a new way, and in the process develops new brain maps and structures. Perceptual learning is also involved in the plasticity-based structural change that occurs when Murzenich's Fast Forward helps children with auditory discrimination problems develop more refined brain maps so they can hear normal speech for the first time. It has long been assumed that we absorb culture through universally shared standard-issue human perceptual equipment, but perceptual learning shows that this assumption is not completely accurate. To a larger degree than we suspected, culture determines what we can and cannot perceive. One of the first people to begin thinking about how plasticity must change the way we think about culture was the Canadian cognitive neuroscientist Merlin Donald, who argued in 2000 that culture changes our functional cognitive architecture, meaning that, as with learning to read and write, mental functions are reorganized. We now know that for this to happen, anatomical structures must change too. Donald also argued that complex cultural activities like literacy and language change brain functions, but our most basic brain functions, such as vision and memory, are not altered. As he put it, no one suggests that culture determines anything fundamental about vision or basic memory capacity. However, this is obviously not true of the functional architecture of literacy and probably not of language. Yet in the few years since that statement, it has become clear that even such brain fundamentals as visual processing and memory capacity are to some extent neuroplastic. The idea that culture may change such fundamental brain activities as sight and perception is a radical one. While almost all social scientists, anthropologists, sociologists, psychologists, concede that different cultures interpret the world differently, most scientists and lay people assumed for several thousand years, as the University of Michigan social psychologist Richard E. Nesbitt puts it, that where people in one culture differ from those in another in their beliefs, it can't be because they have different cognitive processes. Rather, they must have been exposed to different aspects of the world or taught different things. The most famous European psychologist of the mid-20th century, Jean Piaget, believed he showed in a series of brilliant experiments on European children that perceiving and reasoning unfold in development in the same way for all human beings, and that these processes are universal. True, scholars, travelers, and anthropologists had long observed that the peoples of the East, those Asian peoples influenced by Chinese traditions, and those of the West, the heirs to the traditions of the ancient Greeks, perceive in different ways. But scientists assumed these differences were based on different interpretations of what was seen, not on microscopic differences in their perceptual equipment and structures. For instance, it was often observed that Westerners approached the world analytically, dividing what they observe into individual parts. Easterners tend to approach the world more holistically, perceiving by looking at the whole and emphasizing the interrelatedness of all things. It was also observed that the differing cognitive styles of the analytic West and the holistic East parallel differences between the brain's two hemispheres. The left hemisphere tends to perform more sequential and analytical processing, while the right hemisphere is often engaged in simultaneous and holistic processing. Were these different ways of seeing the world based on different interpretations of what was seen? Or were Easterners and Westerners actually seeing different things? The answer was unclear because almost all the studies of perception had been done by Western academics on Westerners, typically on their own American college students, until Nesbitt designed experiments to compare perception in the East and the West, working with colleagues in the United States, China, Korea, and Japan. He did so reluctantly because he believed that we all perceive and reason in the same way. In a typical experiment, Nesbitt's Japanese student, Take Masuda, showed students in the United States and Japan 8-color animations of fish swimming underwater. Each scene had one focal fish that moved faster or was bigger, brighter, or more prominent than the other smaller fish it swam among. When asked to describe the scene, the Americans usually referred to the focal fish. The Japanese referred to the less prominent fish, background rocks, plants, and animals, 70% more often than did the Americans. Subjects were then shown some of those objects by themselves, not as part of the original scene. The Americans recognized the objects whether they were shown in the original scene or not. The Japanese were better able to recognize an object if it was shown in the original scene. They perceived the object in terms of what it had been bound to. Nesbitt and Basuda also measured how quickly subjects recognized objects, a test of how automatic their perceptual processing was. When objects were put against a new background, the Japanese made mistakes. The Americans did not. These aspects of perception are not under our conscious control and are dependent on trained neuronal circuits and brain maps. These experiments and many others like them confirm that Easterners perceive holistically, viewing objects as they are related to each other or in a context, whereas Westerners perceive them in isolation. Easterners see through a wide-angle lens. Westerners use a narrow one with a sharper focus. Everything we know about plasticity suggests that these different ways of perceiving, repeated hundreds of times a day in massed practice, must lead to changes in neural networks responsible for sensing and perceiving. High-resolution brain scans of Easterners and Westerners sensing and perceiving could likely settle the matter. Further experiments by Nesbitt's team confirm that when people change cultures, they learn to perceive in a new way. After several years in America, the Japanese began to perceive in a way indistinguishable from Americans, so clearly the perceptual differences are not based on genetics. The children of Asian American immigrants perceive in a way that reflects both cultures. Because they are subject to Eastern influences at home and Western influences at school and elsewhere, they sometimes process scenes holistically and sometimes they focus on prominent objects. Other studies show that people raised in a bicultural situation actually alternate between Western and Eastern perception. Hong Kongers, having lived under both a British and a Chinese influence, can be primed to perceive in either Eastern or Western fashion by experiments showing them a Western image of Mickey Mouse or the U.S. Capitol, or an Eastern image of a temple or a dragon. Nesbitt and his colleagues are thus doing the first experiments that demonstrate cross-cultural perceptual learning. Culture can influence the development of perceptual learning because perception is not, as many assume, a passive, bottom-up process that begins when energy in the outside world strikes the sense receptors, then passes signals to the higher perceptual centers in the brain. The perceiving brain is active and always adjusting itself. Seeing is as active as touching. When we run our fingers over an object to discover its texture and shape. Indeed, the stationary eye is virtually incapable of perceiving a complex object. Both our sensory and our motor cortices are always involved in perceiving. The neuroscientists Manfred Faley and Tommaso Poggio have shown experimentally that higher levels of perception affect how neuroplastic change in the lower, sensory parts of the brain develops. The fact that cultures differ in perception is not proof that one perceptual act is as good as the next, or that everything is relative when it comes to perception. Clearly, some contexts call for a more narrow angle of view, and some for more wide-angle, holistic perception. The sea gypsies have survived using a combination of their experience of the sea and holistic perception. So attuned are they to the moods of the sea that when the tsunami of December 26, 2004 hit the Indian Ocean, killing hundreds of thousands, they all survived. They saw that the sea had begun to recede in a strange way, and this drawing back was followed by an unusually small wave. They saw dolphins begin to swim for deeper water while the elephants started stampeding to higher ground, and they heard the cicadas fall silent. The sea gypsies began telling each other their ancient story about the wave that eats people, saying it had come again. Long before modern science put this all together, they had either fled the sea to the shore, seeking the highest ground, or gone into very deep waters where they also survived. What they were able to do, as more modern people under the influence of analytical science were not, was put all these unusual events together and see the whole, using an exceptionally wide-angle lens, exceptional even by Eastern standards. Indeed, Burmese boatmen were also at sea when these preternatural events were occurring, but they did not survive. A sea gypsy was asked how it was that the Burmese, who also knew the sea, all perished. He replied, "They were looking at squid. They were not looking at anything. They saw nothing. They looked at nothing. They don't know how to look." Neuroplasticity and social rigidity. Bruce Wexler, a psychiatrist and researcher from Yale University, argues in his book, Brain and Culture, that the relative decline in neuroplasticity as we age explains many social phenomena. In childhood, our brains readily shape themselves in response to the world, developing neuropsychological structures, which include our pictures or representations of the world. These structures form the neuronal basis for all our perceptual habits and beliefs, all the way up to complex ideologies. Like all plastic phenomena, these structures tend to get reinforced early on if repeated and become self-sustaining. As we age and plasticity declines, it becomes increasingly difficult for us to change in response to the world, even if we want to. We find familiar types of stimulation pleasurable. We seek out like-minded individuals to associate with. And research shows we tend to ignore or forget, or attempt to discredit, information that does not match our beliefs or perception of the world, because it is very distressing and difficult to think and perceive in unfamiliar ways. Increasingly, the aging individual acts to preserve the structures within, and when there is a mismatch between his internal neurocognitive structures and the world, he seeks to change the world. In small ways, he begins to micromanage his environment, to control it and make it familiar. But this process, writ large, often leads whole cultural groups to try to impose their view of the world on other cultures, and they often become violent, especially in the modern world, where globalization has brought different cultures closer together, exacerbating the problem.